Today's date and time is June 29th, 2015. It is 10:38 a.m. I am Destiny Griffin, the interviewer, and the oral historian is... Sorry, what is your name?
My name is Wendell J. Harris, Sr.
Wendell J. Harris, Sr. And this project is titled Oral Historians on Plant Clothing in Milwaukee. So I'm going to ask you questions from your childhood all the way to plant clothing and what you do now.
Okay.
So to begin, if you can just tell us your where you were born and the name of your parents and your siblings.
Okay. Oh, wow. I was born in Sherrill, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. My mother's name was Matilda Harris, and prior to that, she was Matilda Williams. My father was Reuben Harris, and my siblings, goodness, there's a lot of us, so I guess I'll start at the top.
Okay.
As Billie Jean, who was the oldest sister, she's the oldest of the siblings that I knew. There was one older than her who passed away when she was a year or so old. And following Billie Jean is there's Josephine, and after Josephine is Geraldine, and then these are my mother's children before she married my father. After Geraldine is Joe Henry, Todd, and then Irma Jean Dickerson and Rebecca Anderson. Those were my mother's six children that she was the mother of when she and my father got married. Out of my father and mother's marriage, there were four children. Ruth Harris, Naomi Harris, Cardell Harris, and myself, Wendell Harris. Before my mother and father got married, his first wife was Miss Salonia, and they had three children together. Reuben Harris Sr., who was my oldest brother, Otis Harris, and his daughter with his first wife, Geraldine Harris. So I think, was that 12? I believe that's 12 of us. We all knew each other. I was next to the youngest in the family, but I've had a relationship with all of my sister's siblings and brothers, and very good relationships. Growing up in our family, what we call today blended families, we were really a blended family. My mother's two marriages before my father, and my father's marriage before she married my father.
So. And what were your parents' occupations?
But my father was a farmer. He was a farmer. He actually worked for people who owned the land where I grew up at in Arkansas, on the farm. My mother was a domestic. She, at one point, my mother was a school teacher, and way back when school teachers only needed a high school diploma, which she had. She was a high school graduate, and at some point, when she was supposed to grandfather in as a teacher without a college degree, when you know it became a requirement, those teachers who had high school diplomas were supposed to be able to grandfather in. I guess more appropriate would be a grandmother in. But I'm talking to a young lady. But she missed that opportunity, and so she ended up working as a domestic, and she did that until she worked as a domestic and as a homemaker until my father passed in 1971. After he passed, she moved to Milwaukee, and she started a career working in the health field. She worked in hospitals here in Milwaukee until she retired. So that's the history of the family's labor, my parents.
Okay. What was your religion, and did you guys attend church? Or?
Oh, I grew up in the Baptist church in Arkansas. I would say born and raised in a Baptist church. For me, I had some real serious questions about what I was being taught and indoctrinated in the Baptist church growing up as a child. So at middle age, I guess, not quite middle age, I left the Baptist church and I became involved with the Unitarian Society. But prior to the Unitarians, I became a humanist, religious humanist. I started the religious humanist movement here in the state of Wisconsin. I was a humanist minister for many years. That work, being a humanist, and my philosophy, my religious philosophy, which is a philosophy that states that we believe that human beings, our absolute responsibility is to each other while we're here on the planet, and that if we're going to survive, we have to work to make life better for each other and afford other people the freedoms to be who they are, who they want to be. So my religious journey has been very exciting. Because for over 20 years I was a practicing humanist minister. I was the only registered humanist minister in the state of Wisconsin for many years. I'm one of the first people in the state of Wisconsin who actually officiated same-sex ceremonies. I'm one of the very first in the Midwest, because there was a time when people from Minnesota and Illinois would actually, through the American Humanist Society, where it set up the organization that my religious affiliation was with, as it ordained through, in order to for a person to come into a particular state, another state, to officiate a wedding or something, that person would have to get a letter from the registered officiant in that particular state, and many times that would be the only person who could carry that out. Fast forward my religious beliefs. I was able to reconcile some of those issues I had with Christianity and reclaim my Christian heritage just 2 years ago, as a matter of fact. I founded the Universal Church of Christian Humanists, and I was able to do that when I was able to say no one else can define my religious beliefs for me, which gave me a way back to my believing in Jesus Christ as the philosophy, as a very vital philosophy to live by. So that's been my journey religiously.
Okay. What are some family activities that you guys did, maybe on holidays or just fun things, sports or anything?
Well, growing up in the South on a farm, working in the fields, you know, we cherish Christmas. Mm-hmm. Always church, you know, that was always a big deal. But as a family, that was about it. Christmas and Thanksgiving for dinner. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty much it. We just, every day was a holiday. You know, your kid in a loving family, you play together, you live together in a small environment. And it just was not a lot of celebrations back in those days, you know. The traditional holidays, but that was pretty much it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you would like us to know about your childhood?
Other than the fact that I had a good childhood. I grew up in Arkansas on the farm. Poor is all outdoors, but didn't know it, didn't have a clue. Just knew that there were some people with nicer houses. And we worked for some white folks who had nice houses, but they were just, in my mind, they were just some folks that we worked for, because I never had direct contact with them in that they were allowed to debase me. One of the things about my childhood was that we always knew in our family, one of our family, all histories that was passed down is that my family did not take nothing from white folks when it came to their children. And that means my mother, My grandfather, I had an uncle that went to prison because he shot a white man for doing some, you know, being disrespectful toward our family members. Actually, the story is we actually lost our family land in Arkansas because trying to keep him from being hung, which he didn't get hung. He did his prison time. So those kind of stories were passed down. Mm-hmm. The story about the time the white man threatened my brother and my mother took the shotgun and went and told him if he do anything to harm her son, that she would kill him. And that's the kind of story that was passed down in our family. So with those stories being passed down, it was very clear to me that I didn't have to take nothing off nobody. Mm-hmm. And my responsibility was, as a member of this family, not to allow anyone to cause harm. So that was my a part of my socialization process, and it has to do with the fact that I've been fighting for these folks for injustice, and the reason why I fought for gay people to have a right to be married and to all the other rights that I thought they should have when I founded the universe, when I founded my Christian humanist ministry. Because the church I grew up in as a child did not sanction that, and I couldn't accept being a part of an institution that would take away other people's, what I think are civil rights to be, in the case of marriage, to have a legal contract, a legal binding contract to protect them from all the other things that happen out here in this society. So, like not allowing you to go see your folks in the hospital because you're gay. All that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you name and tell the locations of your schools that you went to?
Oh, sure.
Grade schools.
I went to Cheryl Rosenwald School, and the reason I'm so happy that you asked that question, my wife is a retired educator, and I asked her just the other day if she knew anything about the Rosenwald Schools. And what a lot of people don't know is that Rosenwald Schools are schools that were started by a white man, a Mr. Rosenwald, to give opportunity to black kids coming out of slavery to get an education. So that Rosenwald Schools was a national school movement. Mm-hmm. I went to school till seventh grade. I left Cheryl Rosenwald at age, then I went to Altima High School. Okay. In Altima, Arkansas, and which became in 1966, I graduated. Altima High School became Martin High School, named after our great principal who was the principal at Altima, and then the school was named after him. In 1967, the school integrated with the white school, so then it just became Altima High School. So I left the year before the integration. And so I'm glad that I left that year because I'm proud to be a graduate of my all-time of Martin High School. It's a really great, great people have graduated from my high school, little school in Arkansas, community of 300 or 400 people. And when I look at our high school reunion book, I look at a document that were doctors, surgeons, and neurosurgeons, and all those folks that come out of that little community. And growing up, with playing with each other, we never even think that some of us had that kind of, some of them had that kind of genius. And then I see myself, so it was a good experience. Certainly racism existed, mm-hmm. but, as a people, we will rise and rise and rise until we straighten this thing out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was your favorite subjects?
My favorite subjects in school? Mm-hmm. That's an interesting question. I guess it would have been political science because I wanted to study political science. When I went to college the first time, I went to college to major in political science or sociology. Those were always subjects for me. Anything that had to do with people and community is what interests me. So for many years I practiced those vocations and educated myself to become capable, I would say comfortable in my view of myself as a political scientist and a sociologist, because my formal education started at age 38 after high school. I graduated from high school with a high school diploma, and I was one of the children that was voted most likely to succeed. But what folks didn't know was that I couldn't spell, and I didn't know why I couldn't spell. But I know I could read, and I could pass tests because I could read. And the questions, if you could answer the question with poor grammar, the question was answered, you could at least get a grade, a passing grade. And I discovered that I could do true and false and multiple choice tests and do as well as anybody. So for me, I went back to literacy school at age 38 to work on my spelling. And then I went back to college because I had already attempted college, not knowing that you had to be able to spell to get through college. So, but I went back to literacy school at 38, and I got now a bachelor's and a master's degree and all that. But
what school did you go to?
I attended UWM. Okay. As a matter of fact, my first attempt at college was MATC coming out of the military. But when I came out of the military at age 21, 22, I was having some issues with my behavior, drugs and alcohol and all that. But I went on to UWM. Somebody told me that I could go to UWM and that you only had to take multiple choice and true and false questions and you could get a college degree. But see, what they were trying to tell me is that if I had a learning disability, that was provision for me. But they didn't know how to tell me that, and I didn't know what a learning disability was. So, but I did enroll in UWM because I was a veteran, military veteran, and they couldn't stop me. Very first class, after the professor go through the syllabus, he tell us all that we have to write a paragraph. And I raised my hand and said, well, look, professor, I was told that this was all true and false and multiple choice. And we laughed and we had a conversation. He said, I think you're a pretty bright guy. Go and come back. And I did. So I left and went to literacy school, worked on myself for about a year and a half. That was my most important degree. 1988, I enrolled at the Literacy Center on 27th in Wales. And I was there for a little over a year. And one of my tutors, Mr. Jim, what was his name? He's a professor, retired professor from Marquette. He and I had a conversation when I first started about what my dreams and aspirations. And I had told him I wanted to be a politician and I wanted to study political science. So we were working one morning. He said, well, Wendell, I think, you think it's about time for you to go back and give it a shot. I'm like, what a shot. He said, go back to UWM. The clock is ticking. He's talking about my age. And he said, you can do the work. So I went back to UWM. I got 90-something credits at UWM, and the reason why I didn't complete my degree at UWM is because I owned my own business, and I was working on a contract with the state of Wisconsin, and the guy who worked for me was a guy with a college degree. In the contract, it called for someone with a degree. And when my employee saw that he had the upper hand, because that's what it was, just like I'm talking to you now, I could see his demeanor change. So I had heard about an accelerated program at Springfield College, where if you had college credits and life credits, you could go and get your degree in 2 years. I went over there and took my UWM credits at Springfield College. I got my degree in human services, because that's, again, where education was always so important to me, and that was a really good, clear example of why you need to have an education. When I saw my employee, the person who depended on me for his livelihood, his attitude changed when he thought he had me with this degree stuff. So so just keep that in mind, because I understand you're a student, right?
Mm-hmm,
yeah. So now I have a master's degree in human services with a concentration on organizational management and leadership. So that's the history of the education piece.
Okay. Are you married?
I'm married to Roselia Harris, Roselia Johnson Harris. We've been married for 20 years. Roselia is my fourth wife. My first wife was a girl that I met when I was a kid, when we were children, living over on Vine Street. We got married when we were 19 years old. We had three children together. That's Beverly Harris. She still refers to herself as Beverly Harris. We had three children. My daughter, Monica Harris, who's my oldest child, second oldest, Andre Harris, and then Wendell, the third. Wendell Harris was our third child. After Beverly and I divorced, almost 10 years later, Brenda Johnson and I got married. We have one daughter, Helen Harris, and Helen is 32 years old. She's a proud college graduate and works in the IT field. I was married briefly to my childhood sweetheart, my high school sweetheart. We were married. We stayed together about a year. And we high school reunion, saw each other, fell in love all over again. And didn't take long to realize that after 40 years, it was not the best thing to do. So we we ended up divorcing. And I've been married to my wife, Roselia, for the past 20 years. And we have one 15-year-old son that we adopted, who's my biological grandson. And she's the mother of two children.
Okay. And do you have any family activities with your children?
Sure. We do everything together. I mean, they are grown. I do the 15-year-old. My daughter comes home for holidays and, you know, we do all that. 15-year-old, he's been our child since he's 4 months old, so we do everything together. And I do a lot of stuff with my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. You know, we do the gym. We go to the gym. Truth of the matter is, I pretty much do. It's unfortunate, and I'm not proud to say this, but I am their father figure. All of my grandchildren, even my great-grandchildren. So that's my responsibility. Unfortunately, the grandson that I adopted, he doesn't know his father. My great grandchildren, his sister, she's got three sons, and I do all of what I needs to be done with them. One, their father's in jail, and so it falls on me. And I always think about something my father said to me when I was a kid, and sometimes I thought he was wrong, but maybe he was a visionary, because he said to me, "Have your children young, so you can grow up with them." And I think about that a lot, because I did. I fathered my children young, and I'm fortunate that I'm old, but I'm healthy enough to actually spend time with my great-grandchildren and my grandchildren to help them along the way. Because if I'd done this as an old man, I wouldn't be living probably to do this. I was telling my wife this morning, one of my great-granddaughters, she's so talented. And I want to take her to Dance Works. I do a lot with the boys. And she always said, "Granddaddy, why don't you do more with me?" And she's that bright. Mm-hmm. And she's so outgoing. And if she can get some support, she could change the world. I can see that. So I'm going to take more time and spend with her just to help her to see a bigger picture of her environment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I'm going to try to stay in order.
Sure.
What was your first job?
First job was, I took a job working in the fields, right? Mm-hmm. That was my first job, picking and chopping cotton. Then I used to ride the bus. Here's how it worked in Arkansas. There's always some enterprising black guy who's going to make some money. So where I come from, it was O.D. Kirkland. We called him Rabbit. Rabbit would take people to the bus. You'd have to, the people who owned the land would give him either 50 cents or a dollar for everybody he took to the field. That would be his cut. He owned a bus and a truck. and he sold stuff. Rabbit took to me. We became very good friends because I was enterprising. Rabbit would sell sodas and stuff, and the water boy in the field would be someone that Rabbit liked, and I would be the water boy, meaning I didn't have to chop or pick cotton. I'd make sure everybody got water. He had little things going like a crap game. I'd have mule crap game. So that was my introduction into the work world growing up in Arkansas, in the fields, picking cotton and hustling whatever was available. I did that, and then I was like 15. I said, I'm not going to work this summer. I took a job in a rice field. The white guy owned the land, told me and a couple of other guys that if we would help him raise a crop of rice, that we would get paid and get a bonus when the crop was sold. We got the little $15 a week for working in the field. But when the crop came out, beautiful crop, I don't know how much money the guy made, there was no bonus. And at that point, I decided I would never work for those folks again. So I came to Milwaukee the next summer, which was my junior year, would have been my going into my junior year, senior year in high school that summer. I got a job working at a body shop. My first job in Milwaukee was working at a body shop, detailing cars, and just learning about, you know, how to help out in the body shop. I kept that job, and after I graduated from high school, I came back to Milwaukee and got the same job back at age 18. And I quit that job when the owner decided that he was going to have a black guy be a supervisor of sorts. And he told me that he would love for me to have a job, but I was too young, and he didn't think the grown-ups who had taught me would work under my leadership. And I didn't like that, so I quit. I quit that job, and I went to JCPenney's. I'm still 19 years old by now. I went to JCPenney's warehouse, and I worked there for a short period of time, because that was, it was like you go in the morning, it was an order, you know, where they take the orders. Back then, orders were not on the computer. You had to go with you had a stack of orders, and you had to run with a big crate, and you fill those orders, and you had to make a quota. And my friend and I, we went to work in May. And we drove up to that place. It was four of us, the guy who owned the car and two other guys and myself in the car. We drove up there, and I had read on Sunday, in the Sunday Journal, a Milwaukee Journal, that A.O. Smith was looking for people, was looking to hire. So we drove up to work that morning. I'm 18 years old, and I was telling my coworkers about the A.O. Smith opportunity. And the two other guys said, well, we going on to work. And my friend who drove on the car, his name was Dickie Bird. We called him Dickie. He was real cool. I mean, he was the coolest cat on the planet. You'd have to see him to know what I'm talking about. I said, man, I'm not going in there. He said, I don't want to go either. So we turned around, and we drove to A.O. Smith. And on a Monday morning, because it was a Monday, I believe, we went to A.O. Smith. We filled out an application. And they said they would call us. They didn't even call us. They told us to come back later that evening to get our medical. And that was 5/9/1968, I believe, or 67. I was hired at A.O. Smith. And I worked there. I was employed there for 30 years until my retirement in 1998. So that was my... that was my opportunity to have a very good paying job. And I know this is what this conversation is all about. Mm-hmm. I started working for a company at age 18, paying what I never dreamed a person would make working for anybody. you know, I mean, really making some good wages. And I was able to stay there to get the 30-year retirement. And, you know, in between that time, being 18 years old, married a couple of times, and all the other challenges that a person faces in their life, I was able to maintain my employment and get a decent retirement, and got one daughter through college and all that. So, and I always, you know, I never really liked anything. But unlike today. So that's, and since my retirement at A.O. Smith, prior to retirement, I planned to retire in 98, so I started my own transportation company. And I ran that company for a few years. My brother and I, he passed away. I closed that down, and out being mental health, been around mental health and all that, I actually owned a mental health clinic, the Reuben Harris Institute for Family Enrichment, alcohol and drug clinic, and other family services. I did that for a few years. And when after that closed, I've been involved with the public school system for many years, volunteering with working with our students, guys who were knuckleheads like myself, and advocates at the same time advocating for services for that student population. I developed a program, the Ambassadors for Peace program, a program to teach kids how to deal with conflict almost 10 years ago. Well, it was more than 10 years ago. I was actually started contracting with MPS to do that kind of work. For the past 8 years, I worked at a school called Transition High School for kids who are transitioning out of the prison system and back into school, working with that student population. So it's been a, you know, it's been a good ride. How I ended up in that kind of work goes back to being a knucklehead who was a struggling kid who didn't really know how talented I am or was, and that had to do with my learning disability because I didn't understand why I couldn't do certain things, and I didn't think that the world would be my oyster, that I would be able to get my pearl, so I took a different route for a few years. And go back to me in Arkansas as a kid who was running the crap game on the bus and all that. You remember that conversation? Mm-hmm. Well, I became a street hustler with a job and a family. And because I thought that was my best option. Because I knew I didn't want to work for nobody all my life. And I knew how to hustle. And that's part of the story. So that's part of the work history. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so let's focus on the plant closing.
Okay, the plant closing. By the time we get to where the plant's closing, I'm now a executive on our union. I'm a union executive. Mm-hmm. I'm the chair of the Alcohol and Drug Committee, which is the committee that work with the brothers and sisters who have drug and alcohol problems. And I'm very active politically, and I know what's happening around the country with plants closing. So prior to the plant closing, there was a process. There was a process. The process was that at the time, and you don't see a lot of it now, but around the country, many corporations were hiring what they called, they would be people who would go in and they would make the company lean and mean. It meaning they get rid of as many people as possible and bring the profits up as high as they can and get as much work out of those folks. And at that some point, when they got the profits up, the companies would be sold to the highest bidder. And that's what happened at A.O. Smith. And I saw that coming because I had been studying this stuff. I'd seen people like T-Bone Pickens and other raiders, they call them. They raid companies and go in and take them over. So A.O. Smith, when we started that process, some of us union leaders, myself, there's just a couple of us, were saying that maybe we shouldn't go along with everything the company asks us for. So they were making a lot of promises that if we do this, if we give this up, they'll stay. And I've been seeing it all around the country where they ain't staying. We just started giving. So the year I left in 98, the company had just been sold to Tower Automotive. Tower Automotive was a company, is a company that buy up companies and resell them and move them offshore. And that's what they did with A.O. Smith. A.O. Smith sold the Tower. It was a very traumatic experience for many people in our community, black and white, because folks took ownership for A.O. Smith. You know, A.O. Smith, a Milwaukee company, generation after generation had worked at A.O. Smith, and they had afforded good opportunities. The children were able to go off to college, you know, with good wages. And then those who did not choose to go to school, a lot of nepotism, you know, you come back and get a job at the company. So when A.O. Smith sold, there was a lot of pain involved for people who had been involved with the company because they felt like they were part of it and unable to make that transition that this was just a business deal. So when the plant closed, for the most part, the north side of Milwaukee closed. If you look at this area, this particular community, many people worked at A.O. Smith who lived in this community, and there was businesses that depended on the income that came from A.O. Smith. Mm-hmm. I go back in the community around the plant. Those older guys who were there when I came at 18, who had fought the good fight to get us in the plant, because they had some real stories for us too about what they had to go through to get the jobs and to keep the jobs, and to always remind us how fortunate that we were that they fought the battle, right? They had nice, well, you know, lawns were really well taken care of. They lived in those houses. They die and pass on. Their siblings, the generations that followed, they don't have those jobs. They don't have resources to upkeep the property. So the neighborhood is gone. So when the plant closed, it pretty much closed the neighborhood for many people. And we have not, as a community, we certainly haven't recovered from it. I talked to you about when I was 18 years old going into a company making the kind of wage that in 1 hour, what I used to get paid for all day. I never thought that I would see the day when a young person would look at a $10 an hour job and think that he or she was about to make it in life. But I see that all the time now. They think that, I believe that, until it's time to pay their first, you know, to keep the rent paid and pay the light bill. Then they realize that maybe this $10 is not so much. But when you've been used to working for minimum wage, that seems like a lot of money. Well, back coming out of the fields of Arkansas, coming into Milwaukee and getting a job at a place like A.O. Smith, you moved into a whole different mindset, because there were so many places like A.O. Smith where you could go and earn a decent wage. The breweries, the automobile plants, the foundries, the tanneries, all that's gone. So plant closings, moving all this stuff offshore, pure business decisions, no regard for the people that would be left, the collateral damage. And so it's devastating. And we're going through another phase now where we, you know, I don't fault the president, free market. Once the markets open up, once the computers became a household name, everybody is in the same neighborhood. So,
were you close to people who were affected?
Yeah, really for sure. I retired, but a lot of my coworkers who I was their union rep, mm-hmm. some of them didn't get to retire. You know, people with 25 years who was looking at being able to walk away with a retirement. It was over until, you know, they could get their retirement when they turned 62. But these guys, some of them were in their 40s. So, yeah, very close. And I had one experience where I was at the doctor, in the doctor's office, and one of my coworkers was, he and his wife was in there. She was seeing the doctor. And I spoke to this man, and he looked at me like, like I was the enemy. And I'm like, man, what's the matter? He said, man, you were part of negotiating that health contract. I'm like, Yeah. He says, well, do you know now I'm paying $1,100 a month for insurance and my retirement is only $1,300? I'm like, no, I didn't know that, because that's not what we negotiated. And he was blaming me. So how was I affected to be in a doctor's office and my coworker do that? Now, I didn't know it because my wife is working for MPS and I didn't need the company's insurance, so I didn't have to buy it. But the company had reneged on what we negotiated. They eventually went back to court and won the case. But that for who are, you know, what happened to those folks in between that before the case was won? So that's been the nature of plant closings in this country. Just destroying people's lives and moving on. And we have to do more to protect the rights of workers. And that's just not where we are now as a society.
So did it affect you and your family?
Me? I got out. Mm-hmm. You know, me, I got out. But yeah, it affects the fact that my, who else in my family's got the opportunity to work at a place like Hill Smith? Right. Yeah.
In another interview, we were talking about it, and they were saying, you know, there are people who turned to drugs and suicide.
Oh, God, yeah, all of that. Yeah.
Can you speak on that?
So, man, yeah, being that I'm the alcohol and drug counselor for the company, you know, for my union brothers and sisters, it was devastating, you know. People just didn't see a way out. And folks lost their homes, you know. You go from making $40,000, $50,000 a year to 12 and 15, working part-time, overtime on some minimum wage job, what's left? So yeah, lots of drug abuse and alcohol, which goes with the territory anyway when you're, you know, living in a, especially working in a hostile environment, like some of the jobs were.
Do you know if pensions being taken away or?
Well, yeah, people who didn't get their pension because of the plant closing, yeah, there's a lot of that. Like I said, there were people who right at the door, people with a year to go. You know, not so much taken because you get your pension, but say if you got 29 years, you started at the company at age 20, you 49 years old, you got 29 years and a year to go, and the plant closed. You can't get your pension until you turn 62. You can't get Social Security, and you can't get your company pension either, 60 or whatever that is. That's a long stretch to wait for what you've worked for and worked for. But that's just what happens when plants close. In some cases, people had their 401ks, and that was good, but that didn't, you know, a lot of folks didn't have that. Because I had not had opportunity to invest in those 401ks and keep the investments going. So, yeah.
Do you have an opinion or opinions on making a good living in Milwaukee?
Do I have some opinions on making a good living? Mm-hmm. Opinion is, yeah. I mean, we should certainly value a person's labor. Companies should have to be required to at least pay a decent wage for honest hard day's work. You know, if a company's making profits that will allow to provide employees with a living wage, they should, company owners and corporations should be willing to do that. But in Milwaukee, not only Milwaukee, but in Milwaukee especially, many corporations are not willing to do that. You know, the corporations, it's all about the 1%, to keep the profits for 1% and to keep the rest of us as serfs working for them. And they're the lords. And working people are going to have to fight that battle again. We fought it in Milwaukee. You know, with the Haymarket, I think over the Bayview massacre, when people fought for their rights as workers and died Actually, people died here. And I'd hate to think that we have to fight the fight with our lives again, but that's where we're coming in this country and in Milwaukee, where it comes to labor relations. Oligarchs control the world, and we have to fight that.
Is there anything else that you would like us to know about the plant closings? Anything else you want to talk about?
In Milwaukee, just like other cities around the country. If my piece is recorded in history, I'd just like to let it be known that, in my opinion, the corporations whose only motive was profit, they were able to live up to their goals, but in the process, closing these factories around the country, around this country, and in Milwaukee in particular, has destroyed many lives. And now there's talk about bringing some of these jobs back on shore, jobs that did not have to go off in the first place. So whenever my message is, always be to business people, corporations, in the future, when this is read, be mindful of the effect that you have on people's lives when you make rash decisions purely based on the profit motive. Thank you.